Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. While the technologies required enabling high levels of automation are advancing rapidly, producing a vehicle that can complete a journey safely and legally without human input remains a big challenge. Three key barriers must be overcome before they can be safely introduced to the market. That is technology, regulations, and public acceptance. We're prepared for you an article written by Hussein Dia, a professor of future urban mobility at Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne, Australia. The piece is titled, Why Self-Driving Cars Are Still a Long Way Off. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Hussein Dia's article. The recent crash of a Tesla self-driving car in the United States, in which two people died, has reignited debate about the capabilities and safety of today's self-driving technologies. Tesla cars include an autopilot feature that monitors surrounding traffic and lane markings, and the company is currently rolling out a more advanced full self-driving system that promises automatic navigation, stopping at traffic lights, and more. Investigators say it appears nobody was in the driver's seat of the vehicle when it crashed. The Tesla chief executive, Elon Musk, has said no self-driving features were in use at the time. Nonetheless, the tragic incident has raised questions over self-driving technology. How safe is it? And how much attention does it require from drivers? Experts talk about six levels of autonomous vehicle technology, ranging from level zero, a traditional vehicle with no automation, to level 5, a vehicle that can independently do anything a human driver can. Most automated driving solutions available on the market today require human intervention. This puts them at level 1, driver assistance, such as keeping a car in a lane or managing its speed, or level 2, partial automation, such as steering and speed control. These capabilities are intended for use with a fully attentive driver prepared to take control of the vehicle at any moment. Level 3 vehicles have more autonomy and can make some decisions on their own, but the driver must still remain alert and take control of the system if the system is unable to drive the vehicle. In the past few years, several fatal crashes involving Level 2 and Level 3 vehicles have occurred. These crashes were largely attributed to human error and to mistaking these levels of automation for full self-driving capabilities. Vehicle manufacturers and regulators have been criticized for not doing enough to make these systems more resilient to misuse by inattentive drivers. For higher levels of automation, a human driver won't necessarily be involved in the driving task. The driver would in effect be replaced by artificial intelligence self-driving software. Level 4 is a self-driving vehicle that has a bounded scope of where and when it will drive. The best example of a Level 4 vehicle is Google's Waymo robotaxi project. Other companies are also making significant progress in developing Level 4 vehicles, but these machines are not commercially available to the public as yet. Level 5 represents a truly autonomous vehicle that can go anywhere at any time, similar to what a human driver can do. However, the transition from Level 4 to Level 5 is orders of magnitude harder than transitions between other levels, and may take years to achieve. While the technologies required to enable higher levels of automation are advancing rapidly, producing a vehicle that can complete a journey safely and legally without human input still remains a big challenge. Three key barriers must be overcome before they can be safely introduced to the market. These are technology, regulations, and public acceptance. The self-driving software is a key differentiating feature of highly automated vehicles. The software is based on machine learning algorithms and deep learning neural networks that include millions of virtual neurons that mimic the human brain. The neural networks do not include any explicit "if X happens, then do Y" programming. Rather, they're trained to recognize and classify objects using examples of millions of videos and images from real-world driving conditions. The more diverse and representative the data, the better they get at recognizing and responding to different situations. Training neural networks is something like holding a child's hand when crossing the road, and teaching her to learn through constant experience, replication, and patience. While these algorithms can detect and classify objects very accurately, they still can't mimic the intricate complexities of driving. Autonomous vehicles not only need to detect and recognize humans and other objects, but must also interact with, understand, and react to how these things behave. They also need to know what to do in unfamiliar situations. Without a large set of examples for all possible driving scenarios, the task of managing the unexpected will be relatively resistant to deep learning and training. Policymakers and regulators around the world are struggling to keep pace. Currently, the industry remains mostly self-regulating, particularly in determining whether the technology is safe enough for open roads. Regulators have largely failed to provide criteria for making such determinations. While it is necessary to test the performance of self-driving software under real-world conditions, this should only happen after comprehensive safety testing and evaluation. Regulators should come up with a set of standard tests and make companies benchmark their algorithms on standard data sets before their vehicles are allowed on open roads. A graduated approach to certification is needed, in which a self-driving system could first be evaluated in simulations, then in controlled real-world environments. Once the vehicles pass specific benchmark tests, the regulators can allow them on open roads. The public must be involved in decisions regarding self-driving vehicle deployment and adoption as well. There is a real risk of undermining public trust if self-driving technologies are not regulated to ensure public safety. A lack of trust will affect not only those who want to use the technology, but also those who share the road with them. Finally, this incident should serve as a catalyst to bring regulators and industry to establish a strong and robust safety culture to guide innovations in self-driving technologies. Without this, autonomous vehicles would go nowhere fast.
around the world with reporters.
After a still deeply disputed election, new United States President Joe Biden has reached 100 days in office with a lower approval rating than any other newly elected president since 1953, excepting Donald Trump. Many believe the country is only in a temporary political calm, which could be broken with the reported return of Trump to the political rally circuit in May.
Well, I don't know if the honeymoon is over. I think in some cases the honeymoon was over a few days after the inauguration, or even before the inauguration.
Biden finally gave his address, where he also unveiled a 10-year social infrastructure plan, which is expected to get many months of pushback from Congress. Many say Biden has had some successes: the coronavirus vaccine distribution, the $2 trillion infrastructure plan, ending the Muslim travel ban, and returning to the Paris Climate Agreement. But Biden has already backtracked from campaign promises in many vital areas. The fight for $15 per hour, the amount and length of unemployment payments, total household stimulus payments, dropping Medicare eligibility to 60 years old, student debt relief, reversing Trump's tax cuts for the rich, and more.
He's reneged on everything he promised, and he comes up with an excuse. I can't do it, or we can't do it because one guy's voting against it. We can't do it because the parliamentarian has decided we can't put it in the bill. I mean, people are pretty much aware that these are lame excuses, and that the Democrats, and Biden especially, are just using these lame excuses to not do what they said they would do.
At 100 days and amid similar economic disaster, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had passed 15 major bills which established hugely influential initiatives. Contrarily, Biden's $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package didn't establish a single long-term program. On foreign policy, Biden has adopted almost all of the stances of his controversial predecessor. He has not lifted sanctions on Iran nor returned to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. Russia's foreign minister said Biden's refusal of diplomacy and lack of respect could make relations worse than even during the Cold War. He has not taken Cuba off the state terrorist list, and he adopted Trump's widely criticized low quota for asylum seekers despite a crisis on the southern border. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The COVID-19 pandemic has led to a sharp rise in racism against Asians, hate crimes against Chinese, East, and Southeast Asians, and the horrific Atlanta shootings in the U.S. threw the topic into stark relief. In Britain, too, violence against Asians has become a bigger problem than it already was. According to one statistic, hate crimes against Asians in Britain increased fourfold in the first quarter of last year, a trend that continues to this day.
Yeah, I was in my eye test appointment, and there was two spaces between me, and every single people that came didn't choose to sit next to me.
I feel unsafe when I'm by myself, so I just like listen to the music. But, you know, some people are still going to say something when they see Asian people.
Before there were any lockdowns, the Chinese and other ethnic communities had already been suffering abuse as a result of fear and misunderstanding stoked by internet conspiracies. Then came former U.S. President Donald Trump pointing the finger of blame for the pandemic at China.
Many of the victims have started telling their stories on social media, where they are receiving increasing attention. Among them, a growing number of Asian healthcare workers, such as this nurse, racially abused by a patient whose very life he was helping save.
Racism does exist in our society. It's mirrored colonialism. Britain has been the largest colonial power, arguably, for the last 200 to 300 years, and an ideology that particularly came with the Victorians has risen to reflect that, one of European supremacy, and particularly British supremacy and white supremacy.
The thought of the UK being unsafe is a sentiment shared by British Asian healthcare workers. Some have thought of moving elsewhere, but have had to stay because of the pandemic-imposed restrictions on travel and immigration.
a disproportional number of them drawn, especially from overseas, who trained overseas, find themselves in subordinate positions within in the NHS. So despite their skill, despite their education, they're less likely to be in substantive consultant positions. They're more likely to be at staff grade, at sub-consultant level, career grade, to find it hard to progress. So there's like a glass ceiling.
The easing or lifting of lockdown measures should ordinarily come as exciting news for many. But for the Asian community in Britain, among them frontline healthcare professionals, the bitter experiences of the past year will continue to impact their lives for years to come. Saeed Puriza, London.
The socioeconomic malaise that has been worsened by the COVID crisis is erupting at an unprecedented level everywhere in Italy. Many hundreds large and small-scale protests have been held across the country over the past months. On Wednesday, thousands of street vendors staged a protest against a city decision to stop the extension of their licenses. They blocked the capital's Ring Road and occupied the central Republic Square as tens of thousands of itinerant street trading businesses are at risk of closure due to an EU directive on free trade.
Italy has been under attack since the EU introduced the Bolkestein Directive, which aims at establishing a single market for services. Our Parliament has already opposed the adoption of this provision.
We have been abandoned in these testing times. How dare they? The mayor wants to impose standards in Rome. She's killing us.
Also on Wednesday, pilots, flight attendants and other airline industry workers gathered in central Rome to stage a protest against a rescue plan to save the bankrupt former national airline Alitalia. The airline is running out of cash for fuel and salaries, and workers fear some 7,000 employees will be sacked if a buyout offer by a group of investors gets the green light from the government.
The government is not listening to our demands. We have not even been paid last month. That's how Alitalia special commissioners are treating us.
The Draghi government is not used to listening to workers' needs. I am afraid this executive can only make unpopular decisions.
Recently, Italy's parliament has overwhelmingly approved the government's European Union-funded pandemic recovery plan worth 248 billion euros. Prime Minister Draghi has pledged the plan would address both the damage caused by COVID and the country's long-standing structural issues.
Italy is at a crossroads. There is the risk that the pandemic may turn into an unprecedented socio-economic crisis that will drag on for a very long time. But Italians also have the opportunity to use the funds from a vigorous stimulus package of the EU to relaunch employment and growth. It remains to be seen whether the country will succeed in this process. Max Civili, Rome.
As the world marks World Immunization Week 2021, people in Gaza don't have enough vaccines because of Israeli restrictions. World Immunization Week, celebrated every year in the last week of April, aims to promote the use of vaccines to protect people of all ages against disease. The Gaza Strip has only received enough vaccines for about 50,000 people. More vaccines are desperately needed as the current volume of doses is not enough for the more than 2 million people living in Gaza. Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of medical supplies, including vaccines.
Under international law, Israel as an occupying power must adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics in areas under its occupation. Israel must supply the people of the Gaza Strip with all necessary means to combat the coronavirus, including vaccines.
The surge in infections and deaths is threatening to overwhelm hospitals weakened by years of Israeli blockade. Currently, there are some 15,000 active coronavirus cases in the Gaza Strip.
The health situation is very dangerous and hospitals are going through very tough times. Every day we lose loved ones because of this deadly pandemic. We need all the necessary help to fight this wave of infections.
The weakness of the healthcare system makes Gaza's population highly vulnerable to further major outbreaks of the deadly pandemic. The enclave's health sector has been battered by the Israeli blockade and multiple wars.
The Israeli blockade since 2007 has taken its toll on Gaza's health sector and left it in a very bad shape. The health sector is fragile and suffers from acute shortages in medicines and hospital supplies to deal with deadly pandemic. Hospitals and medical centers also need more trained medical personnel to deal with the surge of infections.
The Gaza Strip is currently witnessing the worst wave of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Rights groups say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the besieged coastal strip. The measures, they say, are making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A month of campaigning for an official British definition of Islamophobia has climaxed with a flash mob protest staged by activist Maz Salim, who lit up government buildings with the image of her father, Mohammed Salim, who was murdered by a racist terrorist in 2013.
I'm here outside UK Parliament to force this government, the media and the police to recognise my father's death as an act of terrorism, as well as the three mosque bombings in the West Midlands. It's been actually quite horrendous. Over the last 8 years, my father's death has been ignored on the mainstream media. Whenever they talk about acts of terrorism in the UK or on UK soil, my father's act of terrorism, and not only my father's death, the three mosque bombings that followed, have always been missed off the list, even though Pablo Lapshin was charged under terrorism laws. So my anger at the media and the politicians is, and the police as well, is intense.
Despite appeals from the family, British media refuses to prescribe the murder as a terrorist incident, which Ms. Salim believes comes from institutional Islamophobia.
When it's a Muslim who is the perpetrator, they get global media attention, back-to-back news headline. But when the Muslim is the victim, we don't get the same media coverage.
Anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the increase under the current government's watch, with complaints met with silence.
When Prime Minister Boris Johnson referred to Muslim women as bank robbers and letterboxes in 2019, Islamophobic incidences surged, with a 375% spike recorded at the time. Now, with such high-level leadership engaging in anti-Muslim prejudice, can we expect to see meaningful change despite the tireless effort from these anti-racism campaigners? That has yet to be seen. Robert Carter, London.
Amid the continued advancement of the Yemeni army in the city of Marib, the Saudi-led coalition has begun to build new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas to deploy more troops in the city.
What the Saudi-led coalition has in mind by building new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas shows that the coalition is losing the control of Marib. It is now desperately trying to keep the city under its control, but the Yemeni army is determined to liberate all Yemeni lands.
The latest measures by Saudi-led coalition in Marib comes after Yemeni army backed by allied fighters from popular committees took control of strategic areas, including Atum al-Ulya Hill, which is 4 kilometers away from the western neighborhoods of the city of Marib.
Al-Tuma al-Ulya Hill has a great military and strategic importance as it can provide Yemeni army with a good opportunity to achieve its military goals. The hill overlooks the city of Marib, so the Yemeni army will be able to target the enemy inside the city.
The Yemeni army has also intensified its retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. Earlier, Yemeni troops launched an attack with a drone of Qasif K2 against King Khalid Air Base in Asir in retaliation for the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Yemenis say their army will continue its operations to liberate all the Yemeni lands, including the oil-rich province of Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Turkey vowed to respond duly to U.S. President Joe Biden's recognition of the events of 1915 as a genocide. Back on Saturday, Joe Biden said The U.S. honors the victims of the Metz-Jagern so that the horrors of what happened were never lost to history. He became the first U.S. president to officially recognize the alleged Armenian genocide. Immediately after Biden's declaration, Turkey's foreign ministry denounced him in strongest terms, saying the move does not have a scholarly and legal basis, nor is it supported by any evidence. The ministry also summoned the U.S. ambassador to Ankara to voice its protest against Washington. Meanwhile, Turkish defense minister said that the declaration by the U.S. president may disrupt peace in the region.
Historical events should not be used as a tool of conflict and setting an account. They should not be politicized. It is clear that such an environment will negatively affect ties between Turkey and Armenia, Turks and Armenians, as well as regional peace. It should be known that history cannot be rewritten through such political statements.
Relations between Turkey and U.S. have been in trouble, especially after U.S. imposed sanctions on Turkey for purchasing Russian-made S-400 missiles. Ankara is also still angry at Washington for supporting and aiding Kurdish militants in Syria, which Turkey considers as terrorists. This statement is seen by many as an addition to the pile of tensions between the two NATO allies.
I think the declaration by the U.S. President Biden will create further tensions between Ankara and Washington. The declaration is not legally binding. Turkey has always said it's ready to open its archive for evidence. However, the use of this card every now and then by Washington will create a strategic row between the two NATO allies.
Since Saturday, protests were held in front of the U.S. consulate in Istanbul, with demonstrators denouncing the statement and calling on Ankara to cut ties with Washington. Turkey often lodges a formal complaint when foreign governments describes the tragic wartime events in Ottoman Turkey as genocide. Ankara maintains that many people on both sides of the conflict lost their lives. It also proposed to the Armenian side on 2005 the establishment of a joint history commission to reach a just conclusion about the historical facts of that period. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Given the prevailing poverty in Afghanistan, active charities and relief organizations in the country normally increase their support to the most vulnerable people, mainly widows, orphans, and jobless people, during the holy month of Ramadan. Imam Khomeini Relief Committee is one of the most active charity organizations in Afghanistan that has provided many services to Afghans, especially to poor families, since its establishment in Afghanistan at least two decades ago. Representatives of the Relief Committee of Imam Khomeini and Iranian Embassy in Kabul attended this iftari program at one of Kabul's orphanages as a show of support and respect to the culture of helping poor ones.
We view all Muslim countries, particularly Afghanistan, as our brothers. We look to them as our own people. Iran and Afghanistan enjoy too much commonalities in terms of cultural, religion, society, and many other fields. That is why we proudly do whatever in our power to help them.
The participation of the delegation of Iranian embassy in Kabul in events like this is usually welcomed by Afghans.
Iran is our neighbor and an Islamic country. We consider it as a brother nation who has always supported us in different fields such as culture, economy, politics, and social affairs, especially since the war began in Afghanistan.
As observers say, Iran is one of greatest supporters of Afghanistan that has extensively backed the people and governments of Afghanistan since decades ago. Currently, Tehran plays a key role in Afghanistan and is supporting Kabul's policies, especially in terms of bringing peace to the war-ravaged country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The EU's controversial border and coast guard agency Frontex is on course to receive greater power to deport up to 500,000 refugees who have had their applications for asylum in the EU rejected. Frontex is under investigation over allegations that it has aggressively pushed back refugees trying to reach the 27-country bloc.
The European agency always have to comply with fundamental rights. And I don't think that is right to accuse that Frontex is not doing that. And if there are shortcomings in Frontex, they have to be addressed.
The European Commission has just launched its so-called voluntary return and reintegration strategy. The European Trade Union Confederation and several rights groups say it's all about border control, deterrence, detention and deportation of refugees.
Let's have a common asylum policy between EU member states, put it into practice, and then we see where we are. Certainly, this is not going to stop.
Just last week, 130 refugees drowned after their dinghy capsized in the Mediterranean as they attempted to reach the EU. Frontex vessels didn't get to the scene on time. The situation is not good for those who do make it to the bloc. More than 20,000 refugees are currently trapped on Greek and Spanish islands. Those include children, pregnant women, and people with mental health problems. They are surviving in trailers and tents and have limited access to essential services, including water. EU countries have made it clear they don't want to house refugees. Denmark is pushing ahead with plans to deport Syrians back to their war-torn country. Rights groups say this is astonishing given the role the West played in practically destroying the Arab Republic. Aid agencies say the EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and African countries to prevent refugees from trying to seek asylum here. This as the EU is being forced to defend the actions of its own agencies.
We will not accept this Frontex bashing that comes so cheap.
Rights groups say the EU continues to breach the 1951 UN Refugee Convention, which obliges the bloc to protect asylum seekers. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said that the blessed month of Ramadan is the month of patience and steadfastness. Fasting has a lot of positive effects, one of which is the strengthening of patience and steadfastness. Human being usually faces problems and hardships in life. Fasting helps him to face these problems more patiently. Man's being is a source of a lot of tendencies, ischa, which are involved in his move toward perfection. But if these tendencies are not directed in the right course, they will cause many troubles. If man succeeds to administer these tendencies correctly, he will be able to move in the right path. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, said, whenever a hard incident occurs for someone, he should fast. Because God says in Ayah 45 of Surah Baqarah, and take recourse to patience and prayer. Here, patience means fasting. The best element to strengthen patience is fasting, and the best element for remembrance of God is prayer. Anyone who seeks help from these two elements will surely overcome hardships, devilish inclinations, and the carnal desires. In continuation of discussing atonement for fasting, it should be said that if atonement is obligatory for someone, it is necessary to perform it immediately, but it should be neglected so that it is considered as depreciating God's command. Tonight is the first night that has been considered as the night of Qadr. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, on the eve of the 19th of Ramadan, destinies are written. On the eve of the 21st, they are determined. And on the eve of the 23rd of the month, they are signed and finalized. For the eve of the 19th of the month of Ramadan, there are common rites like the eves of the 21st and 23rd of this month, such as the ritual washing of body, that is ghusl, night vigilance and recitation of Joshan Kabir supplication. Besides, it is also recommended to recite this zikr, or remembrance of God, 100 times. Astaghfirullah Rabbi wa atubu ilayh, which means, I seek forgiveness from God and repent to Him. Real repentance is not the one that is just done verbally, but it should be done practically. If we have violated any right, we should compensate for it. If we have damaged any property of anybody, we must retaliate and provide him the same thing. Dear friends, it is recommended to say this phrase 100 times on the eve of the 19th of Ramadan. Allahumma al-an qatalata amir al-mu'minin, which means, O God, curse the murderers of the commander of the faithful. On this night, in 40 AH, the renegade Abdul Rahman ibn Muljam struck the head of Imam Ali, peace upon him, with a fatally poisonous sword at the Mosque of Kufa. And this is another supplication which has been recommended to recite on this night. O God, set in what you decide and determine of the certain affair, and in what you specify of the wise affair on the night of Qadr, and of the determination that will not reverse or change. to write my name among the Hajj pilgrims, whose Hajj is accepted, whose effort is forgiven, whose sins are forgiven, and whose evil deeds are amended, and set in what you decide and determine to elongate my life and to amplify my sustenance. Then the faithful can plead to God for whatever they want at the end of this supplication. Dear listeners, as it was said in the previous episode, we are highly recommended to remember Imam Mahdi on this night, as he is the Imam of the age and God's vicegerent on planet Earth. It is emphasized in the hadith of the Imams to pray for Imam Mahdi on this night and beseech God to expedite his reappearance.
Africa Today.
Recent clashes between tribes in Sudan's West Darfur region have left dozens of people dead, while thousands have fled to neighboring Chad. Now, the killings are taking place after a joint peace mission to the region by the UN and the African Union ended in January. Many internally displaced persons had expressed fear that the government will not protect them after the withdrawal of international peacekeepers.
And we, as the IDPs, we are victims of the wars because we all became orphans. Our government is the one who is fighting against us.
Hello and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today. We are focusing on the endless conflict in Sudan's Darfur region. We are asking, what is the root cause of this conflict, and are foreign powers involved in the suffering of the people in Darfur? In the second part of our program, we are going to talk about how West African nations are losing hundreds of millions of dollars to illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing.
Endless conflict in Sudan's Darfur. Sudan's West Darfur state has seen an upsurge in violence, with members of the Masalit and Arab communities clashing early April in the state capital, Al-Janaina. The Masalit are mainly farmers, while the Arab tribes are mainly herders, with the violence and divisions rooted in disputes over land, pasture, and water resources. To prevent the situation from spiraling out of control, Sudan's government has declared a state of emergency in the region. The vast Darfur region was ravaged by a civil war that erupted in 2003, leaving some 300,000 people dead and 2.5 million displaced. A Sudanese refugee speaks here on life at a camp for internally displaced people. The latest clashes come after the United Nations Security Council voted unanimously last December to end the joint African Union-UN peacekeeping force in Darfur.
Following the overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir in April 2019, Sudan has been experiencing turbulent and fragile transition, especially in Darfur. In August of 2019, civilian political groups and military commanders reached a power-sharing agreement, charting the path for Sudan's transition. A peace deal was signed in October 2020 with a number of rebel factions, but some key armed groups are still active in Darfur. Now, to analyze the ongoing conflict in Sudan's Darfur region, We contacted Edward Corrigan, an international lawyer and journalist based in Canada. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Corrigan. Now, what is the reason behind the recent flare-up of conflict in Sudan's Darfur region?
In my opinion, it's complex. It actually goes back to the 1884 Berlin Conference, where the European colonial powers divided up Africa in a way that deliberately disrespected the sort of cultural, ethnic, and tribal boundaries. So you end up with all the states basically having a very, you know, weak state identity and tribal boundaries, which the tribe just ignores. The other problem is, since 2003, when the conflict erupted, it was exacerbated by conditions of drought, which greatly affected both the groups that have farmland and also the groups that are nomadic and have to move their herds and camels and stuff like that through the areas. There's also the suspicion that there's oil in Darfur, which means that some external actors are interested in destabilizing Sudan and perhaps getting access or control over these oil resources, which are hoped to be there.
Stay tuned for more.
The peace deal last year between some armed groups and Sudan's transitional government was touted as a historic moment, coming following the overthrow of long-serving ruler Omar al-Bashir. As part of the deal, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok appointed a veteran Darfur rebel group leader as finance minister in a cabinet overhaul amid a worsening economic crisis. Addressing the nation after the February cabinet reshuffle, Hamdok said the new cabinet came as a result of a political consensus.
This formation came after a political agreement that happened after long discussions, which took months. Its primary purpose was to save this country from collapse. As you can see, our region has many problems and challenges. Countries close and far from us have collapsed in the past years. We, as Sudanese people, will not repeat this example.
Some of the conflict-affected communities also complained that their voices have not been heard, and they expressed their reservations about the deal.
We've been in these camps since 2004. We want the conflict to end so we can go back to our harvest and to our ancestral home. But we've not been properly consulted on the deal that's taking place or represented, and so we're concerned it may not hold.
Now, Mr. Corrigan, the people in Darfur appear skeptical about the peace agreement signed last October. Now, what could be the factor behind this skepticism?
They're skeptical because there's no peace. So you still have ongoing violence, attacks by the various groups against each other. And you have militia going around attacking and raping people. And so you have a very weak government in Darfur, and they don't have the ability to impose order themselves. And the central government in Sudan doesn't have the ability to put peacekeeping efforts and force to provide security for Darfur. So the situation is reverting to what it was before the peace agreement in October 2020.
Well, thanks for that insight, Mr. Corrigan.
The African Union United Nations Hybrid Operation in Darfur, referred to by its acronym UNAMID, was established on 31st of July 2007 with the adoption of a UN Security Council resolution. On December 31st last year, UNAMID formally ended its operations in the region. People in Darfur protested the departure of the UN peacekeepers at the time, citing fears of renewed violence. Let's take a listen.
We, as the IDPs, we are victims of the wars because we all become orphans. Our government is the one who is fighting against us. Before UNAMID, or I will say in the presence of UNAMID, attacked us in the camp more than three times. So that is why we see, if in the presence of UNAMID, the government of Sudan and the militia, I would say Janjaweed, are attacking us.
Now, has the withdrawal of UN and African Union peacekeeping troops contributed to the absence of violence, and should these troops be reinstated?
Yes, the withdrawal of the troops who served as a peacekeeping force and also as a buffer between the various competing tribal groups and political groups have, you know, withdrawn. So this has created a problem. And yes, I think as a transition, it's probably a good idea to have UN forces, and in particular the African Union forces, coming in a genuine effort to bring security for the region, separate the boundaries, and to help build some civil and political institutions that can restore order and maintain peace.
Now, many people in Darfur are in dire need of assistance, but funding for relief efforts has dwindled. Thousands of displaced people are living in overcrowded makeshift camps. What's the humanitarian situation in Darfur now?
Well, in Darfur, it's a disaster. There's a drought, there's a huge shortage of water, a shortage of food, and some people describe it as the worst humanitarian catastrophe on the planet. Yemen is also described as the worst humanitarian disaster on the planet. So, you know, to say that Yemen and Darfur are competing is not a very good thing, because both are terrible. But there is a lack of resources. The UN, the Western powers, are not putting the food and money needed into sort of, you know, help protect people. And they need to invest in building political and civil infrastructure that can look after the people's interests. And that's not happening. So yes, the situation in Darfur is a disaster, and it's only going to get worse. And it's an ongoing part of the shifting climate in the area, and the expansion of the deserts and drought. So this is all part of climate change that is having a devastating impact on the people of Darfur and also people in other parts of Africa.
Well, thanks, Mr. Corrigan. Well, it's quite interesting there to note that climate change is also a source of conflict in Darfur and indeed other parts of Africa. Now, before we wind up, Mr. Corrigan, is the transitional authority in Khartoum able to restore peace in Darfur?
They are trying to get involved in Darfur, but again, they're relying upon the old tribal alliances, and that is not going to solve the problem, but probably in the short term exacerbate them. And what you need is sort of a more unified civil identity that will bring the various groups in Darfur and Sudan together in a way that is acceptable. As I said, because of the division of Africa by the European powers in 1884 in the Berlin Conference, you know, every African state, quite frankly, is unstable. As a result, you've got, you know, weak states with a very fluid sort of, you know, social and cultural and political environment that moves. So, you know, every African state basically has political problems which they've inherited from the colonial period and haven't been able to overcome them.
Mr. Corrigan there says that most of the conflicts in Africa are the result of boundaries imposed by colonial powers. Now, let us know what you think about that perspective through our social media handle. Now, we're going to take a short break, and in the next part of this week's edition of Africa Today, we shall look at how Europe's fishing fleets are wreaking havoc in West Africa. Don't go away.
Europe's dark fishing fleets threaten West Africa.
Can cargo ships from around the world are moving untracked in African waters, where the rise of illegal and unregulated fishing activity affects everything from local biodiversity to piracy.
According to a report by ENT website, West Africa is a hotspot for what is known in the industry as illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization says West African nations lose $2.3 billion each year to illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. The 5,500 kilometers coastline of West Africa is home to some of the most diverse fisheries in the world. Local fishermen are worried that if this trend of illegal and unregulated fishing continues, there will be no more fish left for future generations.
For more on this subject, we contacted Dr. Efesinechi Okefuria-Rood, a lecturer in sustainable development at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Thanks a lot for your time, Dr. Okefuria-Rood. Now, to start off, first tell us, how serious is this problem of illegal fishing in West African waters by European fishing companies?
Thank you so much for the question. Illegal fishing by foreign vessels is a very big problem. And just to give you a bit of the statistics to get a general idea of how big the problem is, it amounts to the equivalent of 40 to 65% of the legally reported catch in West Africa alone. And then going beyond the illegal fishing, there's also a problem of legal fishing itself, which obviously is sort of exacerbating the extent to which fisheries resources is depleting. And by legal fishing, I mean the continued targeting of species that are already overexploited. So all these things are some of the issues that contribute to depletion of fish stock. And I wouldn't necessarily want to say that it is only European vessels, because unfortunately, Asian vessels are also complicit.
Now, citizens of countries affected by illegal and unregulated fishing blame their governments for failing to invest in sustainable fisheries as a way to build resilience and improve the livelihoods of coastal communities.
It's down to human greed. We local fishermen are partly to blame, but it's also our government's fault allocating fishing rights to foreign industrial vessels. They act like pirates pillaging our ocean's resources. This needs to stop.
The populations of West Africa, home to one of the world's most resource-rich marine environments, is suffering widespread poverty and a scarcity of legitimate livelihoods, in part due to high levels of foreign illegal fishing and overfishing. A Senegalese fish seller here says lack of fish is affecting her livelihood. Has the illegal and unregulated fishing by foreign fishing companies contributed to the rising levels of poverty and unemployment in the region?
The implication of the illegal fishing is absolutely devastating for countries in West Africa and their people. Just to give you a bit of statistics, each year, just for six West African countries, Mauritania, Senegal, the Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, they lose an estimated $2.3 billion to illegal fishing each year. And obviously, the amount that they lose is likely to be more due to the clandestine nature of this crime, means that it is practically impossible to put an amount to it. And so this is the loss to the nations. Imagine, therefore, the impact it has on the people that actually depend on this resource for subsistence. Their food security is undermined. Their income security is also undermined.
Illegal and unregulated fishing also harms the marine environment and leads to depletion of fish supply. Some fishing methods, such as dredging and bottom trawling, also impact the seafloor habitat. What's the extent of environmental impact on illegal fishing?
The environmental impact of illegal fishing is very devastating for countries in West Africa, especially when you take into account the impact of climate change and the impact of pollution in the region already. And so it means that the fact that vessels engaging in illegal fishing are actually able to discard species that they catch, by discard I mean throw it back in the ocean, this leads to pollution because it creates or it results to in oxygen dead zones. These are zones that are oxygen deprived, which means that marine life cannot thrive in those areas. And so illegal fishing is